Iran's president repeats calls for guarantees from the U.S. to revive the nuclear deal as he leaves Tehran for New York to take part in a U.N. General Assembly meeting. The U.S. Central Command says the military's Green Village base in northeast Syria has come under a rocket attack. And U.S. President Joe Biden reiterates his anti-China rhetoric, pledging American forces would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Iranian president says that he will use his visit to the U.S. for the U.N. General Assembly to openly defend the rights of the nation and highlight acts of oppression against it. Ebrahim Raisi also stressed that no meetings with American officials will take place during the visit. This is the first time that Raisi will be attending the annual U.N. gathering. Earlier this week, he told a CBS News network that Iran cannot trust the U.S. with what he called meaningless promises on the nuclear deal. Raisi says that Iran is serious about reviving the 2015 agreement. He noted, however, that this will hinge on Washington offering relevant guarantees not to follow suit on former U.S. President Trump to withdraw from the accord. A U.S. military base in Syria has come under rocket attack, and that hours after unconfirmed reports of a similar strike on another installation housing American forces. The U.S. Central Command says it's investigating the latest attack that hit the Green Village base in the northeast. It claims that rockets failed to hit any U.S. forces or equipment. An attack on the same base last month injured one U.S. military personnel. The U.S. military has refused to withdraw from Syria even after the country won the war against Daesh Takfir terrorists. Washington deploys around 900 troopers in an oil-rich region in eastern Syria. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is no longer expected to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral. A British Foreign Office source said that a change in plans was made by Saudi Arabia without mentioning any reason. The British government faced a barrage of criticism for inviting the Saudi Crown Prince to attend the Queen's funeral. The criticism mainly centered around bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of distant Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His fiancée has called for bin Salman to be arrested for murder when he arrived in London. A number of rights campaigners also cited excessive domestic repression and the Saudi deadly war on Yemen. They said that the occasion would give bin Salman another chance to whitewash his human rights record. According to sources, another Saudi prince will represent the kingdom at the funeral. Now, we've spoken to our London correspondent, Minna Taylor, and she doesn't rule out the Saudi crown prince showing up for the Queen's funeral, despite reports to the contrary.
You know, for me, this is a very, what do they say? It kind of smells like three-day-old fish, this particular decision, because just earlier on Press TV, we were discussing this very issue about just how horrible the optics were for a man who, inside his very own cabal, would have ordered the brutal execution of a dissident journalist inside the Saudi consulate in another country. So let's just look at the audacity of that, just as for starters. So whomever, wherever this decision came from, whether or not the palace could see that the optics were not good and perhaps had a word, perhaps MBS himself would have seen that there were just too many people who now knew where he was going to be, what that meant in terms of the focus being on the most appalling aspects of his regime, or even the British government, who might have had a word to say, listen, we'd love you to come, but politically it's a rough time right now. Why don't you just send someone in? Or this is a big smokescreen, and the man will fly in on his private jet, and we'll see him on Monday sitting front and center, and then he'll fly off. Because these things are about PR, catching your opponents off guard, trying to upset just how people think things might be happening, and then spring in a fast one. So Kaveh, I personally would not be surprised if tomorrow we saw him show up, because this is just, it's curious. It's a curious decision at this point.
Okay, we talked to Amina yesterday, so this, what she was talking about, will happen in almost 3 hours' time. We'll be covering that here for you. And that's for the report of the U.S. military base in Syria coming under attack. From Damascus, let's bring in our correspondent, Mohammed Ali. Mohammed, give us some more details, any claim of responsibility, what's happened?
Yes, according to local sources, eyewitnesses, and some various media outlets, there has been an attack on a U.S. occupation base in Deir ez-Zor countryside. That base is positioned or situated inside Al-Umar oil field. This is one of the largest Syrian oil fields in that area. And also, this is one of the largest U.S. bases of occupation inside Syria. Now, this is not the first time this particular base is targeted. What happened, according to eyewitnesses, was that sounds of explosions were heard over there. Smoke was seen. Also, ambulance vehicles were heard rushing to the area. And it is very important to say that there is no claim of responsibility over who is behind this attack. But this is not the first one. In the past month, such attacks increased on various U.S. forces of occupation locations in that area of Syria. It is believed by many analysts that this is some kind of a popular resistance expressed by the locals of that area, the locals who fought ISIL, Daesh terrorists in that area, of course. But there's no claim of responsibility. And with regards to the result of such an attack, no one was killed or injured, according to reports coming out from that area. But definitely, this is an expression by the locals there that they do not want the U.S. forces to be there. Those forces are occupying parts of Syria. They're looting its resources, and they're dividing the country.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus. Now, Palestinian schools in occupied Al-Quds will observe a day-long strike on Monday in protest against Israel's attempts to impose distorted textbooks. The Palestinian National Islamic Forces, a coalition of political factions, has called for the strike. It says the walkout is aimed at reaffirming the right of the Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not the distorted one. The group also called on international institutions to press the regime not to interfere in the affairs of Palestinian schools. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods against Israel's attempts to prevent schools from teaching the official Palestinian textbooks. They decried Israel's disregard of their rights and chanted slogans such as "No to the distorted curriculum" and "No to Judaizing education." The Palestinians say their regime is trying to deny students their right to learn their own history and culture. Israel routinely destroys Palestinian buildings for lack of permits, but said documents are next to impossible to obtain. The UN says that Israel destroyed 44 homes in the occupied West Bank in the past 2 weeks. Now, we've discussed that issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Israeli regime keeps demolishing Palestinian homes as part of its land grab policy. According to the UN, Tel Aviv authorities have destroyed 44 homes in the occupied West Bank, including in Al-Quds, in the past 2 weeks alone, about 20 of them without prior notice. As a result of the latest demolitions, dozens of Palestinians have become homeless. Israel routinely destroys Palestinian structures for the lack of permits that are next to impossible to obtain. It also destroys the homes of Palestinians who are involved in anti-Israel operations. Human rights campaigners call the move a collective punishment. The demolitions are also seen as part of efforts to make room for settlements. Let's get the latest on this from Mona Kandil, a correspondent who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Also, Saad Nimr joins us, a professor of political science from Birzeit University, also joining us from occupied Ramallah. Welcome to you both. Mona, tell us about the latest demolitions, please.
Well, according to a recent report by the United Nations Office for Humanitarian Affairs here in the occupied territories, OCHA, Israel has destroyed 44 structures and homes owned by Palestinians in Area C and in Al-Quds, in occupied Al-Quds, in the last 2 weeks. Why Israel destroys these Palestinians' homes? According to the Israeli regime, the Palestinians had built their homes without Israeli issued permits When Palestinians go to get the Israeli issued permits, the Israeli regime refuses to give Palestinians. So under unjustified reasons, the Israeli forces destroy these homes, forcing the Palestinians to leave their homes. At the same time, they do not give the Palestinians Israeli issued permits. Because at the end of the day, the Israeli authorities want to confiscate these the lands where these Palestinian homes had been built, maybe because these lands were very close to the illegal settlements, or the Israeli regime wants to use these lands for settlers-only roads to expand the settlements, build new settler units, or even to use the lands for military purposes. So under these unjustified reasons, lack of Israeli-issued permits, for the main reason or for the real reasons, confiscation of land, expanding illegal settlements, the Israeli forces continue to destroy Palestinian homes. And we have to mention that Area C is supposed to be under full Palestinian control. However, Area C is under Israeli military control.
So when you take a look at this act of demolishing homes, Syed Nem, within that act, there's so many illegal violations that are taking place, because you're basically not only taking the home from civilians, you're also producing the taking the land away and using it for other motives. And within all these different consequences, Palestinians' rights are being violated. Where do we stand when it comes to these types of violations in terms of the international community, or lack of action by them, I should say?
Good evening to you and to all your viewers. In fact, the Israeli, this is part of a systematic ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. The whole idea for the Israelis is to make life impossible for the Palestinians and really, really very hard to live. And one of the policies that they are adapting in the West Bank is to demolish houses in area called C, which is supposed to be under their jurisdiction, under the pretension that they don't have permits. And yet the Israeli don't grant permits to the Palestinians in the first place. So the villages and the towns and the areas, with the increase of the population, there is nowhere to go. And they need more houses, so they need sometimes to build a house, even if it is on their own land, in order just for the expansion of the families. And yet the Israeli come and demolish the houses. Not to mention Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a very special case where the systematic demolishing of houses is taking far more even numbers. We are talking about more than 8,000 houses were demolished since 1967 in Jerusalem alone. Which means that, you know, a huge number of Palestinian population in Jerusalem, the Jerusalemite, have to get out of Jerusalem perimeter because they don't have permits. And consequently, the end came as they built on an area called Kfar Aqab, which is supposed to be, it's outside the wall, but it's supposed to be part of Jerusalem. And now we have a kind of a town there with more than 100,000 living there, but it is absolutely not organized. There's no permits and no streets, adequate streets or even facilities. The Israeli, they don't care about this area and they don't do anything about it. And yet, at the same time, they don't allow the Palestinian Authority to be in that area or to organize it. So we end up with more than 100,000 Palestinians from Jerusalem. They live in this area outside the wall in order just to preserve their ID card and to keep in, because otherwise the idea of demolishing the houses in Jerusalem is to ethnically cleanse Jerusalem from the Palestinians. And that was the consequence of that, what they are doing. And this policy is a kind of also a kind of a collective punishment against the Palestinians, especially those who are you know, involved in any kind of activities against the Israeli army, especially in the operations. And what is the problem with the family to suffer because of that? You know, this is the Israelis, you know, this is against the law, and this is totally a violation for the Geneva Convention.
Also, Syed Nemer, thank you so much, Professor of Political Science, from Birzeit University. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review. Thank you for tuning in.
All right, moving on with the rest of this newscast. The U.S. president has reiterated his country's support for Taiwan despite repeated warnings from China not to interfere in the island's affairs. Joe Biden made a comment while responding to a question during an interview with a U.S. broadcaster.
So unlike Ukraine, to be clear, sir, U.S. forces, U.S. men and women, would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion.
Yes.
It's awful hard to back off of something.
Well, Biden also talked about a one-China policy, saying that the U.S. is not encouraging Taiwan's independence. He, however, said American forces would defend the island in case of what are called an unprecedented attack. The comments came amid heightened tensions with China. The two big economies have been on the collision course ever since a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other American politicians to Taiwan last month. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, has conducted unprecedented military drills around the island in reaction to a growing nexus between Washington and Taipei. The Biden administration has also announced more than $1 billion in new arms sales to Taiwan. Okay, that was my part of this news podcast.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
I don't know why,
Eating breakfast in the nature really hits the spot. What a delicious jam. Different taste. After drinking a cup of Iranian tea, I set off. Here, I have the necessary stuff for an exciting adventure. And here's my backpack. Oh, listen. Very sweet. Here we have the birds singing, the beautiful nature, and a new adventure in Iran. Yes, I'm in Shirabad Park in Golestan province, and our today's destination is Shirabad Waterfall. Stay with me. Shirabad Waterfall is in Alborz mountain range in Golestan province, northern Iran. Shirabad Waterfall is in the form of a stairway cascade and includes 12 large and small waterfalls. Its largest waterfall is 35 meters high. There is a cave on top of the waterfalls. Water flows inside the cave, which is a habitat for wildlife species such as the Iranian salamander. A large part of the cave is in absolute darkness. There is a spring at the end of the cave. There are various trees and shrubs outside the cave, such as hornbeam, maple, alder, and moss. Shirabad Waterfall has been registered on the National Heritage List. What a fresh air! Oh, pure oxygen! I am in the forest. There are trees and different types of herbs here. Oh, I love these ferns. Look at them! Shirabad has a very different flora. And over there, you can see maple and alder trees. Oh no! I was about to put my feet on these colorful mushrooms. You know, I'm very careful. I watch my footsteps. You should walk on a well-trodden path so that the nature will be protected. After passing the rocks,
I see the waterfall. Now, here it is, the first Shirobot waterfall. However, it's refreshing. The depth of these waterfalls are different. Some of them are very deep, and some others are shallow. Oh no! It's showering! Oh God! So, let me take shelter in a cave above here. So, a change in the plan. I am now in a cave on the way to the second waterfall. It is called Shirobot Cave. I am here. Thank God I've brought my headlights. Oh, sorry, bats. I disturbed you. The walls of the cave get narrower and shorter as you step forward. At the end of the cave, there is a spring, but unfortunately I can't continue caving because I have to come back to my residence before night. I wish I had time for more exploration. The rain stopped. Here we have clean air and piles of oxygen. Oh, it's dreamy here. And the only thing which is needed now is a cup of Iranian tea.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Bombshell report has the spotlight on major oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Described as fury, the report revealed that explosive files showed how big oil lied to the public and U.S. Congress about their climate targets. Why does this trend continue, something dating back possibly even decades? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how these big energy companies, while raking in billions of dollars in profits due to high energy prices, continue to dodge and lie about their green responsibilities, all the while endangering the planet even more. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Will Maidon joins us, Executive Director of the Climate Action Network International from Beirut. Also joining us is Jody Grage, Vice Chair of the Green Party of Washington State, who joins us from Seattle.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Well Maidon, and ask you about this revelation, which is supposed to be shocking, based on a report which described it as I mentioned in the intro, explosive files over these large oil companies. However, it's not that shocking, is it? Because it's a repeated scenario. What's your impression when you heard about this?
Sure. First, let me correct one thing. I've changed my position. I'm not anymore the CEO of Can International. But just to clarify this, no, there's no problem. In relation to the topic, it wasn't a surprise at all. I mean, we've been always getting information from what the fossil fuel industry thinks and what they say. They knew even before the policymakers in the 80s and even before that CO2 causes global warming, and they tried to hide these facts for a long time. So this is not something new for us as climate activists. We've been working on this issue for a long time on policy, and we knew that this is happening. It's the first time that has been exposed in such a way that really is creating ripples. And this is important because the last line of defense against fighting climate change is actually this vested interest. Now, working on climate change is not only good for the environment and saving the planet and future generation, but it's good for the economy. It's economically viable. The technology is there. We can solve the problem with existing technology. The only problem is political will, and what's holding this political will is the vested interest of some individuals and some companies, especially the fossil fuel industry. And that's why these few individuals are holding the whole globe hostage. And this is what we need to deal with to actually finally solve the climate change issue.
Okay, well, let's take a look, Jody Grage, at the fact that you're having the way this has been described, and I'd like to get your impression on it, as to whether they're being kind to them when it says internal documents showed companies attempted to distance themselves. Now, do you think that that's the correct way of describing it when you take a look at the history of these oil companies, which we're going to get into who they are?
Well, I think you only have to look at the example of the tobacco companies that lied for decades about smoking causing cancer. And you need to look at all the pharmaceutical companies that were getting rich from the COVID pandemic. I think that the oil companies are simply part of the ranks of the industries that are intent on making as much short-term profit as possible. And, you know, the world and the people in it and the whole system of the earth as it's developed be damned. So I don't think anyone should be shocked at the continuation of this line of thinking by large industrial complexes.
Okay, let me get your idea, if I may, about what has occurred. Now, based on the reports and how it's been covered, you have a congressional hearing that was held in Washington, D.C. You have an investigation into the role of these companies. And then you have these companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform were the ones who did this investigation. And you have the oil companies who testified last year, in which it says that they denied misleading the public. First of all, given the history of these companies, how do you have an investigation into these accusations of which for sure they're guilty of, and it takes 1 year before you actually come out with some findings? Now, either these people who are in this investigative committee are trying to portray a different image, or there are strong lobby groups, which these companies do have, lobbying some of these congressmen and women in the U.S. House.
Well, as your other guest said, we have a good example of the tobacco industry. They were able to delay action on tobacco for a long time. And only when those working on the Tobacco Control Convention have been able to include a specific article that prevents the tobacco industry from interfering in tobacco control legislation, when the convention came out and the solution started to happen. And this happened directly when this big scandal came out. Similar to this one, there was this big scandal, and then there was a decision to exclude tobacco industry in putting tobacco control legislation, being involved. Any legislator that gets contacted by the tobacco industry for in relation to tobacco legislation, they have to inform the Tobacco Control Convention Secretariat that they've been contacted to do this and that. So they have to report it. It's illegal for legislators to talk to the tobacco industry in relation to tobacco control. We need something similar for the fossil fuel industry. At the moment, the fossil fuel industry is at the heart of the negotiation. They are in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. They are talking to legislators. They are talking to leaders. They are talking to everyone about what they want and what they need. They're selling wrong solutions and so on. They need to be outside of conversation because there's a huge conflict of interest. Although Paris was achieved, the Paris Climate Agreement was achieved because there were progressive businesses involved. The business could play a constructive role if they want to. But unfortunately, the fossil fuel, they say they want to do that, but as you can see, they are lying and it's not happening. So this is the problem. I think we need to mirror what happened to the Tobacco Control Convention, to the climate change negotiation, remove them out of the conversation until they prove they really want to solve this problem.
All right, this is the part that we're having, where I'm having a problem with, and I'm hoping that other people actually look at it also and question this, Jody Graige. I mean, come on, isn't there a way that when you have these big, huge, multi-billion-dollar conglomerates make pledges, first of all, that there's a control of some kind, that there's some kind of organization controlling the emissions that they're emitting, number one, and number two, when they make pledges, don't they have deadlines? Don't they have commitments? Don't they have penalties? Don't they have a game plan and somebody who's overseeing this, which we're not seeing neither happening here? Am I correct to question this?
Well they don't.
No, this is for Jody Graige. I'm sorry. Well, go ahead, Jody Graige. I'll get to you on that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jody Graige.
One of the problems is if you're looking at the legislators to do this, it's not going to happen because of the fantastic, ridiculous amount of money that the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry and weapons producers and pharmaceutical companies contribute to the legislatures. To think that while all this money comes in, the legislatures are not paying attention to that and are doing what is best for the world as a whole, well, that's at this point a fantasy. So yes, there needs to be legislation. I don't believe it would be easy to get it passed, but why don't we pull in some of these other organizations that are buying the votes to keep doing what they are doing?
Which organizations are buying the folks?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies, the military-industrial complex, big business is doing its very best to keep the legislatures on their side and their holdup in Washington, D.C., and they're paying attention to those people, not to their constituents or the condition of the world as a whole. So I think the example of what's been done with the tobacco industry is a good one to follow, and I certainly think the oil companies should be under that same sort of oversight. But, you know, I think there's further room for further development of that concept.
Indeed.
Over.
Well, when we take a look at what the these oil giants have pledged, basically they've relied on unproven technology, as it was reported, and accounting gimmicks, misleading language, in order for them to hide the reality, is how this was described. And then it goes on to say how they're laughing at the people trying to protect the planet while they knowingly work to destroy it. When we take a look at the unproven technology, what does that mean exactly? Is it along the lines of they are sowing doubts, perhaps, as to whether the green energy is going to work or not in terms of preventing the rise in climate temperature, I guess, or global warming, I should say?
Look, first, I think these companies are doing what's in their best interest and what they're doing. At the end, their pledges are voluntary. No one forced these pledges on them. They went forward and said, these are our pledges. So that's why there's no oversight. It's just them taking this initiative to show that they are progressive, to show that they want to engage in this issue, to keep being involved in these discussions that they're saying that we want to play games, so don't shut us out and so on. They don't want to look bad to the consumer and so on. So that's why they're doing these pledges. They're voluntary. No one can monitoring them. And then they come and say, we're going to solve this by building, let's say, a fossil fuel and attach to it a specific machine that will suck the CO2, you know, carbon capture and storage, and other geoengineering kind of solutions that is unproven technology. Some of it's really dangerous and scary. So there is a solution that exists, but they're trying to find other solutions that would allow them to continue burning fossil fuels as much as they want. So my thinking is that, you know, you're not going to change them that much. There's vested interest. Only their shareholders maybe can hold them accountable. But reaching that shareholders, we tried and we've worked. A lot of organizations are working on that. It's really hard. In my opinion, they need to be left out of the conversation and work on the demand rather than the supply. If the world adopts 100% renewable energy target, you know, the U.S. did that for the electricity. Most of Europe did that. A lot of more than 150 countries have adopted the 100% renewable energy target. You just remove the demand, then the supply has to follow. And we see it in the electrification of transport. You know, this huge, increase or improvement in the electric car happened in the recent years. Such an improvement because of legislation, because of countries said they want to decarbonize their economy, starting with the transport sector and the electricity sector. Uh-huh. So the car industry, when they saw that there's a huge economic opportunity by switching to electric cars, they went for it. Now we talk to the industry, they tell us, you know, we're ready to switch. Just make sure that the government's prepared all the legislation correctly. And, you know, you have charging stations, everything. We are ready to switch. They are not the bottleneck anymore in terms of switching the transport sector. Of course, in countries like Germany, they still have influence. But, you know, even Mercedes, they're producing a car that can go 1,000 kilometers in one charge. You see what others in Japan and other countries, the industry is ready, and we don't see it as a big problem. The fossil fuel industry is still making, you know, their profits. You look at their profits increasing rather than decreasing from fossil fuels. They don't see the same kind of profit from renewable energy. The minute the economics work for renewable energy more, and this is what the governments can do. The minute governments make more profit from renewable energy, these companies have no choice but to switch.
All right. I'm going to ask you this question before we move on to what is really at the heart of the matter here, at least in terms of the lens of that I'm looking at. Jody Graich, it appears when you look at the statements made there by the Oversight Committee, the person that was presenting it, there was a huge billboard behind her of which it said, profits for ExxonMobil, so many billions of dollars. In the case of ExxonMobil, it came in at $17.9 billion for 3 months. BP, roughly around the same, a little more, a little less. Do you think that this is being raised at this point because they are seeing how these big oil and gas companies making so much money while the rest of the citizens of, for example, in the U.S. may be suffering because of a result of high energy prices, that they want to cap the amount of profits that these companies make or tax them maybe even more because there's an energy crunch and crisis, not only just in the U.S., but pretty much around the world?
Well, there are some considerations that should be mentioned here. One is that the technology that is being developed also has its costs. It has environmental costs from mining. It uses rare materials. The amount of the expense of the materials used and the process used to develop these things is not inconsequential. So part of the conundrum here is if you feel a need to make sure that the companies who are doing the next phase of things beyond the oil industry also continue to make massive quantities of money, the whole solution to climate change then becomes dependent on letting the next technology thing make all this money. But you have limits. The Earth has limits, which we are exceeding as far as population, consumption, the availability of raw materials. So it is not reasonable to think that the only carrot, the only way we have of making companies do the next thing is to enable them to make obscene amounts of money while many people have nothing, just like the oil and gas industry has done. We need to refocus things on a longer term basis, and we need to take away money as the only incentive. Some shareholder groups are trying to do this without an awful lot of success, but we're in a recalibrating point that has to do with the carrying capacity of the Earth.
Well, first of all, when you say that, the recalibrating point, that point was reached on many different COP climate conferences, et cetera. We're going to get to a couple of those conferences, but I'd like to do a history check with you, if I may, and really put the focus on the integrity, the ethics that are involved here, or lack of it, should I say. And the prime example that comes up with is what was called the climate deception dossiers. I don't know if you remember that, going back, some more than decades ago, where the whole purpose of these big oil companies was to deceive people by sowing doubt whether climate change, does it really exist? Is the temperature of the globe, of the Earth, really rising? And that was their whole plan, spending millions of dollars to basically promote misinformation. Tell us if we're looking at that to have just prevailed throughout all the years, even now when we hear a report like this come out in the news.
Yeah, again, I said we weren't surprised because we've been seeing it for a long period of time, and actually the fossil fuel industry did succeed. They did succeed in delaying action on the international level, especially, and in the U.S. for a long period of time. In the late 80s, early 90s, the coal industry, U.S. coal industry, if I remember correctly, have trained the Saudi Arabia negotiating team to negotiate in the climate change negotiations to make sure, because, you know, they had similar interests, which is the fossil fuel economy. But we were able to shift that. Yes, it took us a lot of time. It made us waste a lot of valuable time. And we are now at a stage where we want to do the transformational change faster than before. And, you know, in relation to solution, yes, everything has impact. Even us as civil society can have impact in our work. Of course, there should be regulations. It's the regulations from the governments that's going to make the companies adopt correct solutions that don't harm people and planet. We cannot rely on morality. Morality is very subjective. It goes down to the individual. It's not a company. At the end, individuals run these corporations. I've seen some businesses, big businesses, that are more progressive and more inspiring than some civil society organization. So it's just individuals. But just rely on morality and making sure that everyone has this kind of ideology and kind of the way in which, if you want to wait until the planet or the globe, the population on the globe, has this kind of awareness and acts in good faith to save others and think about others, we're not gonna, you know, save the planet or the civilization on this planet. What definitely we need is to find solutions that preserve the planet within its boundaries. We believe there are two limits. There is a smaller limit, mm-hmm. which is related to the limit of what you provide individuals in a welfare state, you know, basic healthcare, food, shelter, and so on. And then there's the outer limit, which is how much we can use the natural resources. And many studies have shown that you can live within existing planetary resources in the same kind of quality of life, in the same kind of population that exists on the planet, and it would work. The problem is some individuals are taking much more than others, and this is where the problem is. But it's also in relation to regulations by the government. To give an example, very concrete examples, just the subsidies that the fossil fuel industry receive, if they just remove that, it can tip the scales towards renewable energy. And we're not saying about making billions, it's not like trying to make the same companies make the same amount of money they're making right now. But what we mean is like the shift in what is good for the planet and the economy has to shift.
Sure, that's a very good point. I'm looking at the clock. We're really running short of time here. Let's move away from these big oil companies, Jody Grage, and look at other companies, other businesses. And this particular headline, which I'm going to forge into another piece of news or concept, I should say, came out in 2019, how 700 companies, which included companies like Facebook and Amazon, were accused of concealing their environmental impact. Basically, this leads to the whole notion of greenwashing, okay, where there's false pledges made towards how they are moving towards that in the way that their business products work. When you have this many companies of this stature that are basically lying about the fact that they're going green in one way or another, how can there be any hope then?
Well, it's pretty hard to see, all right, because the company's basic thrust is to make more money. So I think legislation and oversight has to do with it. I also think that people themselves and organizations can really look at the fact that too many people consuming too much stuff is not going to do it. There must be a better balance between of consumption and population. Climate change is, of course, affecting the poorest,
okay,
the most, and
right,
that isn't sustainable.
Sure, I know that's a topic for another program. Fortunately, we're first out of time. Let me thank our guest there, Jody Grage, was talking, Vice Chair of the Green Party of Washington State. Well, Maidan, what's the name of the company that you work with or work for?
I know I'm a consultant for governments and international organizations climate policy.
Excellent. Very nice. Who spoke to us from Beirut. Thank you for that. I apologize for that mistake. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vatari and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Dr. Hojatul Islam Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dr. Karimi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's we want to talk about the main Quranic look at the woman, and how does the Quran look at the woman. So many people might believe that, for example, inside the religion of Islam, there is a kind of man orientation, a strategy, or lifestyle. And the women has no place inside the religion of Islam based on the Quranic teachings. What's your answer to that?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. There are many discussions under this question, but mainly those people who refer to the Quran, they take, for example, the story of the creation of Adam and Eve, and then because of some narrations, especially, because of some references to the Old Testament, they claim that Eve was created from a part of Adam, for example, from the rib of Adam, as it's been mentioned in some of the narrations, and based on the Old Testament. But the point is that when we refer to the verses of the Quran about the creation, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that the creation is based on a nature or a gem.
Yes.
And all people, whether men or women, are created from the same nature and gem. There is no difference. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, يا أيها الناس اتقوا ربكم الذي خلقكم من نفس واحدة. O people, beware of your Lord who created you from a single soul.